Hello and welcome to our final seminar on our online course about the UK's 2015 general election. We now know the result, so we'll be discussing why that result happened and what might be the implications for the future of the UK. I'm joined again today by Professor Charlie Jeffrey and Professor Ailsa Henderson, and we also have Anthony on Twitter ready to take your questions and reactions. So we've taken a selection of your questions from both Twitter and the forums, and today we're going to be discussing Scotland at Westminster, the election result and why it happened, questions about a future possible EU referendum, and then some other questions that don't fit into those themes. So we begin with the theme of Scotland at Westminster, and Maureen Penhaligon has asked a question about the Conservatives. So she asks that as the Conservatives now have a majority in Parliament, albeit a small one, has the Scottish Lion still got roar but no bite? Will they be unable to bring Scottish issues to the heart of Westminster? Charlie.
Thank you, Alan. An answer in two parts. In some senses, the 56 MPs that the SNP won in Scotland out of 59 extraordinary achievement will have no grip because there is a majority party. And the majority party, if it manages to organise and discipline that majority, will get through what it wants. So in that sense, no. And clearly the SNP's ambitions before the election had been to exert parliamentary influence over an Ed Miliband-led Labour minority government where those 56 seats would have had an impact. Under a majority situation, no, there isn't that impact. However, what I would expect the SNP to be doing in Parliament is to be using the platform that the Parliament brings in various ways through the committee system. They will get committee convenerships, probably most likely the Scottish Affairs Committee, but also one other, I think, according to the standard distribution key. They will be on all committees. They will have questions at every Prime Minister's question time. And I think we can imagine that a party which has, in recent years at least, a strong reputation for discipline will be using those opportunities quite rigorously, quite professionally, to get its messages across.
Yeah, I would agree with that, absolutely. I think certainly there's a certain amount of creativity that's required from the SNP. On the one hand, it can work with the other opposition parties to hold the government to account. And we know that the Conservative Party contains within it certain divisions. It's certainly been a particularly rebellious time for Parliament, you know, defections from the party whip on about 35% of votes between 2010 and 2015. So it can find common, if it can find common cause with some of those rebellious elements in the Conservative Party, then it might be able to change legislation. However, we know that there are some issues where the rebellious faction within the Conservative Party is on the other side of the Conservative Party from the SNP. Europe is one example. So it's unlikely to find common cause in terms of changing legislation on that front, but it might well find common cause in terms of bringing down a government. It still only takes one vote to for a vote of non-confidence. So within the House as a whole, there are opportunities. Charlie's absolutely right. The committee system provides opportunity for influence. You know, that Scottish Affairs Select Committee has only 11 members. At the moment, there's only one SNP member on it, so it's inconceivable to imagine that they won't be an overwhelming majority on that committee. Not all committee members of that committee need to represent Scottish seats, but still that's an opportunity for influence. The other thing we know is that the Conservative Party manifesto referred to an English Grand Committee. And the Scottish Grand Committee, which used to just look at legislation that dealt only with Scotland, hasn't met since 2003, but it's not been disbanded. It can still meet if it wishes. And if we know that those regional English committees, which met between 2008 and 2010, didn't examine legislation that only dealt with their region, but just looked at legislation to examine how that might have a particular impact on their region, then we might conceive of how a rejuvenated Scottish Grand Committee could perhaps operate, particularly if it's sitting alongside what might well be an England-wide, an English Grand Committee as well. Right. So there's opportunities there, but it does require a little bit of creative thinking about how we use the system, how they use the system to work for them and to represent Scottish interests.
Hmm. And of course you have the clerks and the resources and the platform of Westminster to be used as well, which are potential resources.
Well absolutely. I mean, you could always debate reserved matters in the Scottish Parliament. There was never any problem with that. But it's slightly different if you're debating reserved matters within Westminster than if you're debating reserved matters in the Scottish Parliament. And now both venues are available to them.
Yep, and just before we leave this issue, we've had a question from an anonymous person who asks, do you think that the identity vote in the UK England has favoured the Conservative Party in front of the SNP threat and the lack of confidence that Labour doesn't govern with them? So did that play a part? Did the fear of the SNP perhaps play a part? Advantageous to the Conservatives?
Well, there's two sides to that. Certainly we know it's a valence issue up in Scotland. So we know that there wasn't really much difference between the social policy arguments of the SNP and Labour. But for Scottish voters, the difference was that they trusted the SNP to go down and actually deliver on those things, and they didn't trust Labour. And I think under Ed Miliband, Labour has been seen to Scottish eyes as a more English party than it was under Gordon Brown or even under Tony Blair. In terms of how effective that Conservative argument was about, you know, if there's a Labour government, it'll be essentially driven by or dancing to the tune of the SNP. Certainly we have anecdotal evidence that was effective. Whether that's behind Lib Dem voters, you know, abandoning the party and voting Conservative, we're really kind of waiting on the data from the British Election Study to be able to say definitively, but it does appear that might well be going on, yeah.
Okay, we move on now to our second section, which is about the election result and the implications for the parties. And our first question in this section is from John Meeks, who asks, did Ed Miliband hurt Labour? Ilse, we know that Ed Miliband's leadership ratings were behind David Cameron's through the campaign, although I think they improved during the campaign. Mm-hmm. Is that a big factor for Labour?
Oh, I think absolutely it was. I think I think there's a couple of things that were going on. And we can distinguish between what happened to Labour in Scotland and what happened to Labour in England. I think in England it lost the argument about policy, and I think in Scotland it didn't lose the argument about policy. It lost the argument about performance, and it lost the argument about the effectiveness of that party to go down and represent Scottish interests. But I think they're very different things. I think people didn't necessarily buy the argument about an end to austerity politics and stop the Tories at all costs. I think that argument didn't work in England, but I think that there were different mechanics, different dynamics operating in Scotland, and it was more to do with the complete and total absence of the Labour Party to identify what is the constitutional future in post-devolution UK. What do we do with England? You know, is devolution enough? What do we do with Scotland? Do we move towards federalism? Do we have some sort of asymmetrical model, a symmetrical model, a confederal model, sovereignty association, sovereignty partnership? It hasn't had a strong and coherent and principled voice on that. The last coherent and principled voice was on devolution and the need for devolution, and since then it hasn't developed one. And one might argue that it didn't need to while there was a Labour government in the UK, and there was a Labour coalitions in Holyrood, Labour coalitions or administrations in Cardiff. But it lost that opportunity. It should have used that time to figure out what the next argument was. And because it didn't have that, that's why it lost in Scotland. It's a very different argument in England and Wales, I would say. And there it lost the right versus left battle, whereas the right versus left battle kind of took a back seat in Scotland, I would say.
Charlie, will we combine that question with Paul Teasdale's question, who simply asks, in that context, what now for Labour?
What now for Labour, indeed. To connect to two or three of the last questions, the question about England and appealing to England on national terms is really interesting this election, because the Conservatives did. They said they had an English manifesto. It wasn't written down anywhere, but they talked about it. This was about English votes on English laws in the Parliament and English rate of income tax. We heard also about a Carlisle principle, a principle that there would be a report on the consequences for England of policies taken forward by the Scottish Parliament. All of these designed to feed on that imagery of a Labour Party in the SNP's pocket, as it were, as we saw in those election posters. So the Conservatives really mobilised on a national basis in England, and that really may have had some effect in terms of securing votes. We'll see when we know more about the British election study. What it also clearly did was expose the absence of an English policy in the Labour Party. The Labour Party had had lots of opportunities to think about England and the way it's begun to emerge as a political unit, had really tried to avoid it, I think in a sense, because it felt that it was weaker than the Conservatives in England and wouldn't benefit from an institutionalisation of England in the UK political system, but would need to rely on its strength in Scotland and Wales. And of course, there is no strength in Scotland anymore. So I think that was a real weakness in Labour's strategy. Mm. And effectively, they have to come up with an English policy, an English manifesto, if you like, going forward, because it is clear that there are different electoral battlegrounds now in the UK, defined on national lines, and you have to compete where your opponents are. And the Conservatives have laid out a terrain around articulating English issues. Labour has to be there in future.
Absolutely. So is that the future for Labour then, to look at something in England that emphasises their commitment to that?
Well, it has to be creative in constitutional terms about how the various nations of the UK are given effective voice in the UK political system. More generally, I think, we've seen lots of criticism from Labour, prominent Labour politicians since the election, about the strategy that Ed Miliband took, which was perceived to be, to reduce it to very simplistic terms, zero-hours contracts, bad, mansion tax, let's tax the rich. So focusing on the disadvantaged and the rich and forgetting about everybody in the middle. And a lot of the debate that we've seen already, and a lot that we're going to hear about in the next period as people like Chuka Omunna have declared their candidacy, is reclaiming that middle ground and engaging with the Conservatives about the relatively well-off, the aspirational middle section of the electorate in England. And effectively, if Labour doesn't do that, it's not really going to be with much of a chance of recovering its position.
Mm. We also had a question from John Meeks just about the Liberal Democrats, so we just discussed the future for Labour. We just briefly discussed what might be the future be for the Liberal Democrats.
That's difficult. That's a difficult one. It's rare to see such decimation. The Liberal Democrats used to have a regional stronghold in the southwest of England. It is completely gone. They lost everything there. They've got a few MPs scattered to the winds in the different parts of the UK. It's going to be tremendously difficult for them to regain the kinds of strength that they had. I think one of the challenges was, I don't think their weakness is simply about that sense of lack of trust around tuition fees in particular. That's one thing that really hammered them. Another thing was that they used to get people voting for them because they weren't part of the group of governing parties.
No.
This was a way of expressing your discontent with the choices that the big parties gave you. And as soon as you go into government, you lose that. So a combination of trust issues and a combination of trust issues with losing that anti-establishment protest vote leads the Lib Dems where they are now. Now, they are outside the establishment, so they've got an opportunity to rebuild that. But they've also got two other players in that terrain in the form of UKIP and the Greens on different ends of the political spectrum. But they're also capturing dissatisfaction with the two main parties. So it's a very, very difficult situation to recover from.
Yeah.
Charlie's absolutely right. It used to be the case that if you were an incumbent, you weren't necessarily rewarded for that in the voters' eyes. And we saw different effects for different parties. So if you were a Conservative or a Labour incumbent and you were seeking your first re-election, you actually were coming from behind. You have to overcome that in order to get elected. But if you were a Liberal Democrat incumbent, you started with a 6% advantage. So we used to be in a world in which being a Liberal Democrat candidate who had already sat in Parliament was a positive thing. It was really good for candidates and everyone else was disadvantaged as a result. And there are arguments there about why that might be the case, but we're certainly not in that case now. Another area where they were previously very strong was the Highlands and Islands in Scotland, and Alistair Carmichael retained his seat, but obviously Charles Kennedy lost his. I mean, one thing I think that, one lesson is stay out of coalitions, because certainly that hasn't done them any favours in Scotland in the 2011 elections. We know it hasn't done them any favours in a UK-wide context. But another is this notion of occupying the centre ground. They're in a curious position of having won a lot of the policy arguments, but lost the support of voters. Mm. So the debate is shifting. It's now seen as uncontroversial to suggest that 16-year-olds should be allowed to vote in different elections. That's an old Lib Dem policy. We're talking about federalism. The Conservative Party is talking about federalism. That's an old Lib Dem policy. So they're in the peculiar position of having won the arguments, but lost voter support. Mm. And I think that's something that they need to... There is a valence issue lurking there. And also, if Labour is debating over whether it moves to the centre or further to the left or camps straight where it is, well, then if I were in charge of Lib Dem strategy, one thing to do would be to make sure if Labour is moving to the centre, you're already there, you're already occupying it, and you need to occupy that terrain more obviously than they are at the moment. And remind, you're agreeing with all of us, but it's a difficult thing.
Yeah, a difficult task ahead for both of those parties. Shall we at this point take a question from Twitter, Anthony?
Yes, Helen, we've got a question from David Thomas, who asks, how much sway will the Tory backbenchers have in the new government with such a slim majority? What will they want?
Yeah, and this was a question from Michael Hardman, who says, after his victory at the general election in 1982, John Major won a majority of 21, but experienced considerable difficulties keeping his own party united. Given the present government's majority is smaller than that of the Major administration, do we foresee that David Cameron will have similar problems?
I think Michael Hardman gave us the answer to that question, right, in the way that he phrased it. Not for a bit. I think the sense of relief in the party that the Conservatives won a majority and didn't have to face another period in coalition or in opposition to some kind of Labour-led alignment will gain the Prime Minister some loyalty, but I suspect that will be tested before too long. One of the issues on which it will be tested, of course, will be Europe. There are different views on EU membership in the Conservative Party. There is a pretty substantial part of the party which would like to be out of the EU, which isn't that interested in David Cameron's ambition of staying in following some relatively unspecific renegotiation of terms. That's the most obvious issue on which differing views in the Conservative Party may make it hard for Cameron to manage his majority. Another one may well be Scotland. We have the expectation that the Smith Commission proposals, as put forward in a draft bill in January, will come forward formally as a bill in this first session of Parliament. There will be pressure, not least because of those 56 SNP MPs, to move beyond that. There will be resistance from some Conservatives in moving beyond that. There is a view among many that, Scotland gets a pretty good deal as it is. Why are we giving more? So on those two broadly constitutional questions, there could be real challenges, and that's before we get into the challenges of cutting spending. Now, cutting spending as a policy was fine for the Conservative Party as a whole to endorse in the run-up to an election. It will have effects in constituencies in due course, which will be felt in some constituencies more than others, and including some Conservative constituencies, and that will test loyalties too. So having such a slim majority, well, it may well be a challenging management problem.
Mm.
And absolutely. I mean, I think that majority will whittle down with long-term illnesses, absences, by-elections. It's not a healthy one. And if we're looking at records of government defeats, and we look at the big majorities we've had recently, they lost kind of 4, 5, 6 big votes If you're looking at minorities or slim majorities, you know, Wilson and Callaghan, they lost 25 votes, 30 votes, 31 votes, those governments. That's not a position that that the Prime Minister wants to be in. I think it's also an issue of, you know, what is likely to prompt the division or pull apart Conservative MPs. And certainly, even if we're looking at Margaret Thatcher's governments, it was the votes on Europe that were the problem. You know, she lost 5-6 votes. I think 3 of them were on Europe. That's no less likely to happen now than it was. And if there is an issue where SNP MPs, Plaid, Labour MPs can find common cause with rebelling Conservative MPs, it's on the issue of Europe. They want different things, but it's not inconceivable that they would join together in a non-confidence vote if they weren't getting what they wanted. They might want different resolutions, but that middle path might not satisfy either, and they might use a non-confidence motion to bring down the government to get what they want. And whether they get what they want is another debate.
Mm. So there are some disadvantages to winning, perhaps, that needs to be looked at by the Conservatives. Before we move on from parliamentary things, a question from John Anthony Webster, who said that previous governments with small majorities have had the ability to call the next election date to their advantage. Fixed term parliaments act removes that ability. As the function of the act was to lock the Lib Dems and Tories into a binding coalition, can you see a circumstance in which there would be an attempt to repeal it? What are the benefits of the act for the current government? And could there be a scenario where the government calls a vote of confidence against itself to get round the act? So a lot there, Ilse. But with the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, where do we see that going?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in some ways, things aren't really all that different than they were before. If you are a government and there is a no confidence motion and you lose that even by one vote, then you are no longer the government, I suppose. So there's the 2-week cooling off period, which allows it to be used almost as a threat rather than an automatic trip to the polls or request for dissolution. So you've got that 2-week cooling off period. The other thing that's different is that, providing there are no confidence motions, the election takes place in 5 years. If you want an earlier one, it requires a 2-thirds majority to get that. So if it were to go that route, they would need to convince more people to support them. But you could absolutely contrive to lose a non-confidence motion if you wanted a faster trip to the polls. However, we know that the head of state could easily say, well, hang on a minute, you know, I could see another way that this might work. And if they've lost members through attrition, through by-elections or long-term illness, it is entirely possible that the Queen could turn around and say, you've lost this no-confidence motion. I don't think that automatically needs a new trip to the polls and another election. I can clearly see another party or a leader of another party that would have the confidence of the House, so it's risky.
Mm.
But it was always risky. So it's not, I don't think it's more risky than it was before.
Okay, we also want to say something in this section perhaps about Wales, which we haven't talked about yet, Charlie. Dorothy Thomas has a question where she says, why such little interest in the outcome for Wales? What now for Wales?
Well, I guess such little interest because not that much changed. There weren't that many seats that changed hands in Wales. The Lib Dems, of course, suffered, and the Conservatives benefited, but it was a pretty static picture. One very interesting thing under the surface of that static picture, though, is the support for UKIP in Wales. UKIP did very badly in Scotland. It didn't really register anywhere significantly in Scotland. Did very well in England, and as well in Wales. There are many facets of UKIP which suggest that it appeals to a particular kind of English voter, English identifiers who are worrying about England's perceived lack of representation in the UK political system. So why UKIP does so well in Wales is a bit of a mystery. And colleagues in Wales we work with quite closely tell us that this is the Welsh anomaly, but they haven't yet explained it to us.
So more on Wales to come, perhaps. Before we leave this section, we have a question from Amy Dalrymple, who says that, I think she's from the US, she's saying that in US coverage of the election, it was noted that David Axelrod advised the Obama campaign and that the Conservative campaign was advised by Jim Messina. Do we think that US election tactics translate into the British system, and did they have an impact on this election result, do you think?
Interesting question, yeah. There's a limit to how portable those techniques are, in large part because a general election isn't a presidential election. So it's different, not just in the sense that it's not binary options, but also because you're electing your MPs, and the party that has the largest number of MPs typically forms the government, and it's the leader, it's the person who happens to be leader of that party that becomes Prime Minister. So this direct notion, you're not as a voter casting a direct ballot in terms of who will lead you, but rather you're casting a ballot for who will be your local MP. And so there are always going to be elements of local campaigning that are at the heart of UK general elections. And we know from the literature that not having local campaigns has a detrimental effect on your own party support and on turnout. So, well, yes, I think some of those techniques were used very effectively, and certainly it's changed the national campaign. There are two campaigns occurring in UK general election campaigns. There's the national campaign, where we're focused very much on the leaders and the leaders' debates, and then there's the local campaign where we're looking at the candidates. And one thing we've heard kind of anecdotally is that certainly in Scotland, that local element was maybe less relevant than it has been in the past, that people were very much focused on the leaders of the parties, and in particular the leader of the SNP, liked the leader of the SNP, and were casting their ballots not necessarily because they knew or liked or approved of their local candidates, but because they had faith in the person who is currently First Minister of Scotland. But right now it's very much at the level of anecdotal evidence. We're still waiting on data to confirm that. But I would say, yes, absolutely, it's changed the national campaign, but because of that local element, there are limits to how much change we can see.
Mm-hmm. Okay, with that we move on to our final theme for today, which is the EU referendum and its impact on British politics, or a potential EU referendum. So Madge UK asks, Cameron says he's bringing forward the EU referendum legislation and this is likely to get through. If the UK votes to leave the EU, how might this affect Scotland and the SNP?
Okay. Indeed, one of the big themes for this Parliament, I suspect, and it was set up by comments that Nicola Sturgeon made in the election campaign, and that was that she thinks if there is a vote to leave, then that vote should be endorsed by all of the constituent nations of the UK, and we can expect that some kind of amendment will be put forward to a referendum bill to that effect, and we can expect that it will be rejected by the Conservative majority. But what it points to is that there is quite some evidence in public opinion that attitudes to the EU differ by nation, at least between England and Scotland, less so between England and Wales. And if there were, for example, a tight vote in an EU referendum, either marginally in or marginally out, then it could be that England and Scotland would be on different sides of that vote. So it might be that England was kept in the EU against its will by Scottish preferences for remaining, or that Scotland is dragged out of the EU against its will by the weight of the English electorate. Neither of which would be particularly propitious signs for the continuation of the UK in its current form, because these would be decisions about a fairly fundamental issue divided on national lines. And because there is that possibility, it's going to be a very, very live issue throughout this Parliament, and the SNP will continue to make that point. You, the majority in England, and remember that the Conservatives presented themselves very strongly as an English party, you, the majority in England, are not going to decide our future when it comes to the EU.
We've also had a question from Anne Murphy on this topic, where she asked that, is there any possibility that the referendum on EU membership will lead to a permanent split in the Conservative Party in the manner in which it split in the late 1840s over the repeal of the Corn Laws? So clearly this would be a difficult issue for them, Ailsa.
Absolutely a difficult issue, but if we know anything from the comparative literature, it's that when a party splits, it is less electable than before the split. And so the splits are never very long-lasting, because they realise that when you're splitting your support, you're doing, it usually happens in one of two ways. You're splitting on an ideological issue, which means the split happens, you know, along the length and breadth of the country, or you're splitting on a regional issue, which means you're losing regional support. You're more vulnerable in that latter situation because we know that the electoral system rewards regionally concentrated smaller parties rather than it does reward, you know, smaller parties with diffuse support. So you're more vulnerable to those kind of splits than you are on a pure ideological issue. But what's interesting about this issue is that, as Charlie outlined, this is both. It's an ideological issue in England, but it's also a regional one within the UK. But if anything, we know governments that divide that split on issues of policy quickly find ways to heal that division because it puts them at risk of never getting back in. And certainly, you know, the most obvious example is the Canadian one, but it's not the only one.
Well, we have an example in the UK, not of a government splitting, but an opposition splitting with Labour losing the SDP with several senior figures defecting to create a new party. I think 1982, I can't remember the exact year. But then the Labour Party didn't get back in government until 1997. So there is a real penalty if you are unable to hold your party together. You're likely to, you're manifestly splitting the support that went into creating its current strength, and that means you are unlikely to recover the full level of support, at least for some considerable time.
Mm. On the Conservative Party, the Canadian example is the Conservative Party splitting and going from a majority down to two seats in the 1993 election and not getting back into government until it brought back in the two regional sides that had kind of defected to other parties. So yes, it could split, but it won't be for long if it wants to get back into government.
Yeah. Okay, just before we leave this, I think we might have covered this already, but Paul Filipek has asked, he says that the manifesto commitment to the referendum and continued membership of the EU is arguably the most significant issue in the government agenda. Could the university experts give some preliminary comments on the possible consequences and parliamentary procedures that might be involved leading up to the referendum? So I think we've covered this, Charlie. I think possibly it's expected the SNP would put down some kind of amendment about majority support across the different nations, and that could be the government in some difficulty, perhaps.
You neglected to read the last sentence in the question.
I like that one.
Maybe this will be the subject of the next MOOC to be organised by Dr. Conroy.
Well, absolutely. I hinted at it last week, but referendums are clearly on people's minds, and we also have another election coming up next year in Scotland and Wales.
I mean, there will be a real discordance between the heat of debate that we will have about an EU referendum bill and the content of the bill, which will be really simple and straightforward. You don't need an awful lot to be in a referendum bill, but the debate about it will be very significant, but quite probably fairly meaningless, because the Conservatives have a majority, and I suspect on that issue the majority will hold. The majority will be challenged when it comes to campaigning yes in, no out, when the Conservative Party will be split. But getting the referendum bill through, unamended, I imagine, will be pretty straightforward.
Mm. Before we do have another question, but I thought we might just take some comments or questions from Twitter. Anthony, do we have any reaction?
Yeah, Alan, we've got one comment from Heather Desserot, who said, what an election it was. Also got another comment from David Thomas, who says, how is EU membership even a point of discussion in UK politics? It's been contentious for my entire life. Perhaps it's time to move on.
Okay. Do you want to comment any further on that? I feel we've done the EU.
Yeah, well, comments on the election, because it was quite an extraordinary election. Given the very clear and seemingly definitive differentiation of voting behaviour between England and Wales on the one hand and Scotland on the other, with the near disappearance of the Labour Party as a significant force in Scotland, And that happened in an extraordinary way. I was lucky enough to be in a TV studio all night, and following the early results, and I think one of the swings which delivered one of the early SNP seats was about 20%. And we were wondering, well, what's the biggest ever constituency level swing in a competitive election in the UK? And we found the answer. It's 21.8%. And then that was broken very quickly afterwards, and it kept getting broken until it hit 39.3% for Glasgow North West, which was too big a swing to be accommodated by the graphics that the BBC had prepared. It was a quite extraordinary situation. More votes for a party in Scotland than ever had been registered, a bigger national swing than ever had been registered. It was a record-breaking election. So it was well worth that question being raised by the colleague on Twitter.
Good. Ailsa, do you have any wider comments about the election? What election?
No, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, before the election, I was kind of counting the number of times that a party's gone from third or fourth place, and then in the subsequent election, taking the seat. And in Scotland, it had happened kind of 11 times since 1964. Well, we got double that in one night. I mean, it's just... You know, you can't use enough superlatives to describe the radical shift in people's partisan preferences. Not necessarily political preferences or values or social policy preferences, but partisan preferences. You just, I don't even know what to say. It's just, you can't use enough superlatives to describe what's been going on in Scotland. But I think also, do you know, the UK-wide election result, if you're looking at the party, at the second place results, also, I think the rise of UKIP as well. You know, a year ago we were maybe predicting that they were going to take more seats, and so we might say, well, you know, nothing's really happened if we're looking at the eventual figures. But if you're looking at where the number of constituencies in which they came second, I think it's well over 100. It's about 120. Mm-hmm. And if you look at where that is as well, I think there's something happening as well in England. Yeah.
There obviously. Is indeed. One other thing about the extraordinary nature of the election, and picking up on some of the discussion last week, was about opinion polls. Yeah. And the way that the opinion polls were not reflected in the election outcome. Or I'll qualify that, because they were reflected in the election outcome in Scotland, yet people have been quite reluctant to believe that the SNP would actually do as well as the opinion poll projections suggested, which was 55 or more seats towards the end of the campaign. So people didn't really believe the opinion polls in Scotland. They believed them in England, and they were completely wrong, completely underestimating in the end the Conservative support, which ended up at 37-38%, whereas it had been, I think, a maximum of 34%. In the polls, and that's what delivered the majority, that moving apart of the Conservatives and Labour in England, which the opinion polls had not picked up. And I wanted to put the question over to Ailsa as to why she thinks that might be the case. Why were the polls so wrong in England?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I mean, I think in some ways the polling errors that we're looking at now are similar to the polling errors we discussed after the 1992 election, the famous Waterloo of the polls. And part of it is those quota samples. You know, probability samples and random probability samples allow us to make that link between the fact that what is true for the sample is also true for the population. And when you have a non-probability sample, that link disappears. And we've been using online polls with quota samples under the argument that, well, because they're cheaper, we can do more of them, we can talk to more people, and we can overcome what we know is a weakness of the methodology. So I think what we're seeing is an inherent weakness of the sampling methodology that we always knew was there. The other thing is, we know with online polls that we're capturing a portion of the electorate that is distinct. It's not like the electorate as a whole. It is one that is online. It is, as I've said before, it's typically younger. And that is a problem that you can kind of get around with waiting. What you can't get around is the fact that this is the most polled election we've ever seen. And those, it's not just that they're online polls. They're online polls of panels of people who are on sampling frames for polling companies. And we're polling them again and again and again and again. And the more often we poll them, we're making them less like the population that they're supposed to represent, knowing that they're already unlike them because they're online. So we're giving them sophisticated questions about who controls this and who controls that. We're priming them with all of these questions, and we're taking them a little bit apart from the people that they're supposed to be similar to. So I think there's that. I think the other thing is the polls themselves were not too bad. Certainly they were closer in Scotland. People did expect that what happened in the referendum would happen in the election, that you would get that shy no effect occurring, or that people were over-representing whether they would vote yes. People thought they were probably doing the same with the SNP. So they were closer in Scotland than we thought. But even in England, what was the problem was not necessarily the polls, but the seat projections. And the seat projections have to take account of local circumstances when they're making calculations about, well, will this MP win the seat? And so the thing that they were maybe not doing was taking account of, well, what do we know about incumbency? What do we know about incumbency effects for female candidates versus male candidates? So what do we know about the local dynamics here? Are they facing three competitors or six? You know, all those kinds of things. Some of them weren't in the models for seat projections. Some of them were. But this feeds into what I was talking about earlier. We used to know that if you were a Lib Dem incumbent, you had a 6-point advantage. Mm. And if you were a Labour or a Tory incumbent, you were facing a 1 or a 2% disadvantage. Those incumbency effects appear to have not existed at all in this election. So even if the seat projection models were taking into account, you know, what the literature says about the importance of local context, the importance of incumbency, the importance of gender of the candidate, they might very well have been even further out because things changed so radically. I mean, it was a difficult environment in which those polls could predict what was going on. It's a party system that's changing, so it's in a state of flux. And the other thing we know is that until very late in the day, 20% of people didn't know how they were going to vote, and 25% in Scotland. And we also know that people don't often tell the truth to pollsters. They're more likely to maybe say the truth in the company of their own bedroom when they're filling in the online survey than they are over the phone, or than they are if the interviewer's sitting across from them face to face. I mean, we can't compel people to tell us the truth, but we can certainly ask the questions in an environment that makes the truth more likely to bubble to the surface. And I think it was a difficult environment in which to do that. But some of the old problems we had, we still haven't we haven't fixed. And I think that, you know, this discussion within the ESRC to create an online probability sample is probably coming at a very important time. I think it would be a useful development.
Well, plenty to think about there. I'm afraid we've run out of time for today. So it just remains for me to thank Charlie Jeffrey, Ilse Henderson, Anthony Salamoni, and our team who have helped us to put together this live online seminar. I hope you've enjoyed the course, and as we've hinted at today, there might be opportunities in the future to join us again to examine more of the implications of British politics in referendums and elections. Thank you for your participation on the course.